All right. I want to tell you today about the possibility of the so-called Casimir invariants. There's an infinity of other invariants besides energy and entropy, which are based on these Casimirs, which are they're functions whose gradients span the null space of the Hamiltonian, of the symplectic tensor J in a non-canonical formulation of fluid turbulence. So that's in the sense of Arnold and Morris and Holmes have all worked on this non-canonical description of two and three dimensional fluids. And in that sense, there are these quantities called Casimirs. That's where the name comes from. We don't really need to know that today. You can just think of them as arbitrary C1 functions of the vorticity integrated over the domain. And it basically, it's a relabeling symmetry, okay, behind this invariant. And the question is, can they cascade, and which way do they cascade? Do they go to the small scales or large scales? That's the main question I want to ask today. So this work, I'd like to acknowledge two people in this work. One is Jahan Shah Davoodi, who was until recently at the University of Toronto. And I met him when he was a postdoc with Bruno Eckert, and he posed this question to me, because I think he had seen some speculation in the literature as to which way these Casimirs should cascade. And I'd also like to acknowledge contributions of from my student Malcolm Roberts, who was here, but he left last week. Okay, so this is, of course, the 2D vorticity equation. The advective term here, we're going to Fourier transform, and we're going to call it S. There's S written out. There's one way of writing it. You can see that it's a convolution in Fourier space. And this is we're going to have just molecular viscosity and some kind of stirring force. And of course, when there's no viscosity and no forcing, it's well known that these quadratic invariants, the energy and the entropy, are conserved. And then Fjortov in 1953 had this cartoon where he argued based on conservation of energy and entropy, and the fact that entropy is just k squared times energy, that he gave this little example here. Incidentally, these aren't meant to be a triad. These two, three wave numbers are not meant to be a triad, but they're just bins of wave numbers, typical scales of wave numbers, one smaller than each of them consecutive here. And he argued then, by just looking at this balance, that energy has to go to large scales and entropy has to go to small scales. It's just like doing first year physics. It's the same thing as collisions, right? The same equations. That's fine, but the question is, what happens with the with these Casimir invariants? I guess I should mention that Craik and Leith and Batchelor went further in this and argued that the energy should cascade with a power law minus 5/3, and the entropy should cascade with a power law with exponent minus 3. To the entropy goes to the small scales. However, that was in an infinite domain. In a bounded domain, the situation may be different. Now, what I'm considering here, this is a simulation that Jung Tran and I did a few years ago. The simulation itself took 18 months, and finally we just got bored and stopped it. But it was running on a high-end workstation. And what we did was we forced right here. We had molecular viscosity, no hyperviscosity, and no Ekman friction. This is the pure 2D Navier-Stokes equation. And what we found is that after, like others, we found that eventually, this is a k to minus 5/3. I should have labeled it there. This is roughly a k to minus 5/3 slope here. And what we found is that as we approached, the minus 5/3 would appear as a transient phenomenon, but as you ran longer and longer time, you would approach this lower spectral boundary, you'd get a pileup of energy here, and what I think happens is you're getting a direct cascade by energy bouncing off this lower spectral boundary, and hence that's why we get the k to the minus 3 slope. But that's just a speculation. And Jung and I had a theory that was based purely on energy and entropy conservation that said that in the limit of infinite Reynolds number in an unbounded domain, so when this spectral boundary goes off in this direction and this dissipation range goes off in this direction. In that infinite limit, an unbounded high Reynolds number domain, then this exponent and this exponent should add up to minus 8. And you see we're getting there, we just haven't quite reached that limit. The other interesting thing is that this minus 3 cascade seems to creep in and destroy the minus 5/3 cascade. As you go on time, that point there moves along to the right and eventually gets, we conjecture, since we can't run this long, we conjecture the minus 5/3 range there will be eventually totally destroyed. What you see when you see minus 5/3 slopes in the literature, either they've only shown you a transient and they haven't run long enough, okay, or they have introduced some Ekman friction here to try to damp away this thing. And your question? Yeah.
What is 5.7?
So do you know how we look?
Sorry? This is 5/3 here.
No, what is 5.7? Should it be, can you explain this?
Oh, well, like I said, it's partly contaminated from the viscous dissipation range because we haven't really gone to, we're mostly concentrating on this region here, so we don't have a very resolved, this is not an entropy cascade here. If you could go further, if we had a bigger computer, if someone buys me one, then I expect in the limit that you would, according to this theory, you might get a k to minus 5. That's what we were suggesting. And we were actually suggesting that the, instead of saying that, a lot of people blame coherent structures for this steepening. Instead of saying that, we actually said that it could be that these energetic considerations which require this minus 3, these two numbers to add up to minus 8, that these energetic considerations alone allowed coherent structures to exist. We don't know that, but we were saying no one has really shown a causal relationship that the coherent structures cause this steeper slope. Now the history of this is for many years people were getting steeper slopes in the entropy cascade. And now some higher, and I will show you, there are cases where you can get the Kolmogorov slope of minus 3. I will show the cases like this later. So I'm not saying this is always what you're going to get. But what I'm really trying to say is in a bounded domain, things are a little different than the KLB picture. Okay.
So this picture corresponds to a very long time when you already have
extremely long time, right. So this is affecting the fact that this forms affects what's down here. Everything's all coupled, highly coupled. 2D is particularly non-local.
Yes. Is there no friction in your system?
No friction.
No friction.
And this is the pure Navier-Stokes.
Also, the experiment that was Hua told 2 weeks ago, that this, well, it's not actually K minus, it's just a pile up. Is this pile up will eat all the 5/3 part?
But here you see the slope seems to be quite close to minus 3, but there's no theoretical explanation.
Okay,
no.
This is just a coherent vortex. I mean, it's like in this Lebedev-Cherkov numerics where they've seen it for a very, very long time and they had dipole and of course 5/3.
Of course, this K minus 3 is not related to any K scale.
There is
it's
no
related to coherent structure.
It's a coherent structure.
It's one big
vortex that grows in the domain.
Yeah, so that may well be. And
full condensation.
But this part of the spectrum is pretty much influenced that you are enforcing incompressibility. So
yes.
And there you should in nature, so this is yes. What we have in accretion disks.
Yeah.
So then when you're forming shocks and
I mean in nature there's always something that's going to take this energy out. Yeah.
Right.
I want to just emphasize there was a few years ago a misconception that the energy here would continue indefinitely, and a simple Poincaré inequality establishes that the energy is bounded. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's well understood now. Yeah.
What's the resolution of the simulations?
This one here. Well, that's, I think the number of, probably it was a 4,096 by 4,096 in terms of total number of modes, and then that means the number of D'Alius modes, which I universally quote, because that's, I like to be honest, the number of real physical modes was, I think, 2,300, two-thirds of 4,096, yeah. This is the old days before I had developed implicit padding, which was only something I developed in the last year. So all the numbers now are going to look different. Last week I gave a talk on this recently advanced that you don't need to use the two-thirds. You can use the two-thirds de-aliasing, but you don't actually have to zero pad anymore. We have new routines that are called implicitly de-alias convolutions. They're prepackaged. They're available on SourceForge. And they're much faster, like twice as fast, and use in 2D two-thirds of the memory you would normally use, or in 3D, four-ninths of the memory. So this is a big advance. You save time as well as memory. The thing I know, we know that no one is using these, or has been, we know this is new work because there's a signature of this method. The optimal power, the optimal sizes is 1 less than a power of 2. And so in the future, when people ask me this, what resolution, I will quote you numbers like 4095, and that will be the total number of modes, physical modes. That will be the number of physical modes. No one should be quoting the modes which are just part of your buffer you use for dealing. That doesn't really, that's not physical. Yeah.
So when you say this this ran long, this is all relative because it's a theoretical simulation on a computer. So what would it be? What would be the typical time scales one would expect in any of these typical experiments where they have a, what have you ever gone in and actually checked how long was that?
I mean, like how many
eighty turnover long in an experiment? I mean, I'm just wondering.
I mean, I think the interesting question is how many eighty turnover times, large-scale eighty turnover times was, and it was thousands. I don't remember.
Yeah, but a thousand. How long is the? She's not here anymore.
How many eighty turnover times in the experiment? In the experiment, hundreds, because we actually average. I mean, how to see that this K minus three, what you call it, is actually vortex. Mm-hmm. You just take a coherent part of the flow. We average it over 30 turnover time, large scale turnover.
Yeah, how long is that? And I want to know how much that is in the world clock. I want to know what the world clock time is. If you're talking about long times, this might not be
half an hour.
Yeah, that's not a long time limit. I mean, really, we're not convection. We wait days, in weeks. Okay. We make measurements over 2-3 days, even in the onset of
convection. Depending on the size of the books.
Now, look, when we do experiments in spiral decay or something, where we just want to know what are the final states in spatial temporal chaos, we actually wait for 2-4 days, let the experiment run to find out whether we are experimentally out of the transient, right? So when you say it's 1,000, you're actually looking at a transient. You're not.
No. What do you mean transient? I mean,
of course, a transient is still changing. So that's a definition of a transient.
Because there's no friction, then it's changing. Yeah. Okay. What do you mean transient? I mean, it's a system without friction.
Like 7 years ago when I ran this, I don't remember whether it's like thousands or millions, but it's a huge number like that. Yeah.
It's not even forced, no? There is no forcing in this, right?
Well, of course, there's forcing. There's forcing right here.
It is forced, of course.
It is forced.
So it is in a numerically
compared to cascade. My guess is you didn't even start to talk about the subject of it.
No, that's right.
But so maybe you'll just go ahead and start.
The conjecture is right on.
We discussed everything. This is not the
I just threw that in for historical.
Let's talk about
right, okay. All right. So in addition to the energy density, there are uncountably many other Casimir invariants. Any continuously differentiable function of the vorticity is conserved by the nonlinearity. And to show that, it's very easy. I've written the calculation out here. You take your favorite function of the vorticity, you differentiate it, and you use the chain rule, and so the equation of motion then naturally comes in, and so you put the equation of motion in, there it is, with the minus sign, and now you collect this together, again using the chain rule, as a directed gradient on of F, and then you can integrate by parts, get rid of the minus sign, and now you use incompressibility, and so you see that any function of the vorticity is zero. And the physical explanation for this is that all that's happening is that 2D turbulence, or the Euler equation, simply rearranges parcels of vorticity. Okay. Phil Morrison always likes to say it's like stacks of poker chips that you're rearranging on a board, on a checkerboard. So do these invariants, the question is, this infinity invariance, does it play a role, a fundamental role in the turbulent dynamics, in addition to the quadratic energy and entropy invariants? Do they exhibit cascades? I mean, why did Kraepelin, Leaf, and Batchelor ignore these? Polyakov has suggested that maybe the higher order Casimir invariants do cascade, that they cascade to large scales, so an inverse cascade. However, Iancke has suggested the opposite, that they cascade to small scales. So I decided that, in fact, John Shaw came up to me and said, can I see who's right? Can we have a shootout here and see who's right numerically? And I immediately told him, no, you can't, because high wave number truncation destroys these Casimir invariants. And here's the reason why. Only the quadratic invariants, Montgomery calls them the energy density, he calls them rugged invariants, are the only ones to survive. And so here is the vorticity equation written in a nice, simple form, with the convolution here written explicitly. And the reason that you get entropy conservation is when you multiply, I'm using stars for complex conjugates, when you multiply by omega k, you have now the product of a symmetric tensor, completely symmetric in these wave numbers k, p, and q, this thing here, and the epsilon, which is completely anti-symmetric under interchange of indices. By the way, I use epsilon here for this coefficient because it reminds me of the Levi-Civita symbol, but of course it has nothing to do with it other than it has that same symmetry, anti-symmetry. So you got anti-symmetric times a symmetric tensor, the result of the contraction is just zero. Okay, so that's why energies, entropy is conserved. Okay. How about, for example, looking at Z3? That's what I'm calling the global integral of the cube of the vorticity. Well, the conservation is an exact property. It follows from this law, from this symmetry here. I'm just written the first term out, because that's all we need to look at to see what goes wrong when we truncate. So what is truncation? With truncation, we don't put the full omega into this spectrum. We only keep terms omega k, or omega l, I'll call them. So l is kind of a general index. We only keep part of the spectrum where l is less than or equal to some capital number k. That's our truncation wave number. And we've zeroed out all the rest of the ones. So by zeroing out, we're basically zeroing out the terms in here. We're putting a restriction on p, putting a restriction on q and r and s, but not k. Now, if we go back to the previous slide, if I did the same thing here, the reason the entropy does survive truncation is I can restrict omega k, p, and q, and that restriction enters symmetrically in my summation. This is called detailed balance, okay, or detailed energy conservation, or entropy in this case. The higher order invariants do not enjoy this property of detailed conservation, and therefore setting omega l equal to zero for high wave numbers breaks the symmetry in the summation. The sum over k is treated differently, and therefore destroys Z3, the invariance of Z3. However, the missing terms involve very high wave numbers. They involve the vorticities for very high values of p and q. And so one might expect for a well-resolved simulation that you're going to get almost exact invariance of Z3. Whatever that means, almost exact. Okay, well, we'll see how well can we actually do in a real case. So we decided to test this. In fact, we will see that it is possible to get a sufficiently well-resolved simulation, so these things are conserved enough that you can actually answer the question, do they cascade? So how does the entropy balance work? First of all, let's go back to Z2 and just to set the notation. So here's the equation for the entropy balance that you get by multiplying by omega k star, and then we're going to integrate over wave number angle, and this is what we get. So this is the entropy spectrum. It evolves according to there's a dissipative term here, and then we have a term here that comes from integrating the nonlinear term with the over angle, and this term here is coming from the forcing, this F term. Okay, and following Kraepelin, we will define the entropy transfer. Just a note about terminology, actually in Kraepelin's paper, he refers to both of these things as transfer functions, and it's a little confusing. Sometimes people call this a cumulative transfer. I like to not even call this T thing transfer. I think it's too simple a thing. It's just a triplet correlation, after all. And it's just a triple, so I call it T stands for triple, not transfer, and pi is the transfer. So when I talk about nonlinear transfer, it's the integrated, the cumulative quantity I'm talking about. Okay, what that represents, it's the nonlinear transfer of entropy into the wave number region k infinity. So a positive value means the entropy is flowing to the high wave numbers. And that's what we'll see that we get. And not only will it be positive, it'll be independent of k. So if you integrate this equation from k to infinity, then what you get is a nonlinear part coming from pi, and the the remainder, which I gave it the symbol epsilon z, and it's basically the contributions from the linear term, the molecular viscosity, and from the forcing. And so there it's defined there. It's the total entropy transfer via dissipation forcing out of wave numbers higher than k. This minus sign I found convenient to introduce here, so that in a steady state, these two would agree. So, so if first of all, let's talk about conservation. When nu is 0 and f is 0, then entropy conservation can simply be stated this way. That's just the integral that we considered before over all, or we considered a sum. Now we're going to consider an integral over all wave numbers. And so that means, therefore, you can either define pi the way we did, or you can define it like this. And both definitions are out there. My sign convention is one such that if pi is positive, that means entropy is flowing to higher wave numbers. Another important property is that pi of 0 is 0, and pi of infinity is 0. Those are by definition and the result of entropy conservation. And more, and most importantly, as I mentioned before, that in a steady state, pi and epsilon should be in balance. And that balance is an excellent numerical diagnostic for when a steady state has been reached. Because often you evolve a spectrum, and you see it, you know, it's slowly changing, especially at the large scales. It takes a long, long time, and after a while you give up, and you say, right, that I'm done, my simulation has saturated to a spectrum, and it's not going to change very much. But then if you run a little longer, maybe a few more months, you might find, in fact, it has changed a tiny bit. So when do you know when it's really converged to a steady state spectrum? This is a much better diagnostic for that, because you often find that these things are still not in balance, even when it looks visually to have stabilized. So we'll check that here. So here is a run here now. First, let's look at the red curve here. This is a very low resolution run, and I'll explain why it's low resolution in a few minutes. So here I'm forcing at wave number 2, and I did put friction in. Okay, so now everybody should be happy with that. I do have some friction. Okay, and I'm just concentrating on the entropy cascade here. And now in the red curve here, this is just molecular viscosity. It's kind of hard to see an inertial range here because my resolution is so limited. But one thing you can do if you want to really mimic the Kolmogorov idea, Kolmogorov considered a situation where there was vanishing viscosity in this inertial range. If you really want to mimic that, we can actually introduce a cutoff, and so that the molecular viscosity now starts only at this wave number here, which is 300. That's what KH is. So it's a high wave number cutoff below which there's no viscosity. Now, you may think that's a terrible thing to do, but it's like a hyperviscosity, but of infinite degree. Okay. And the interesting thing is that you get, this has been observed by others too, that you get less of a bottleneck effect by going to this extreme case. I'm not really a proponent of hyperviscosities, but if you're going to do it, you might as well do it in style and go all the way. Okay, so this is, it's just interesting to do. It allows us to at least, for this talk, it allows us to see cleaner manifestations of an entropy cascade and a cascade of these higher order Casimirs as well. So I'll just show you the difference in the slopes. The advantage of having that cutoff is that you can very clearly now see how you're getting close to this minus 3 correction. And what you can even do is fit this to a logarithm, and it fits very well. I've done that in some of my papers, and it's really amazing how good the agreement is with the logarithmic correction that Creighton suggested in his 71 paper. And one of the things I wanted to emphasize, because of many people misunderstand this logarithmic correction being something small, near the forcing wave number is very significant. Okay, it can change your exponent from being minus 3 to minus 4. That, I believe, is part of the reason for steepening that people have observed in many early simulations that weren't well resolved. It's partly due to that fact, and partly because the viscous range pulled the thing down, as you can see here. So here we never made it to -3, so this is just molecular viscosity here. Okay, and so here you wouldn't really know what's going on. So that's the advantage of introducing the cutoff. And here is the energy transfer. The forcing wave number is here, and we see that the transfer is negative. That means transfer upscale. I'm not really trying to resolve the inverse cascade, but you can see that at least the idea that Feuerstaub had is more or less right. And here we have an enstrophy transfer that is now this is with the cutoff. Okay, the blue curve shows the nonlinear part of the transfer, so this is the enstrophy transfer, and the red curve shows the other terms in the equation, the linear and forcing terms, and now that they are actually in balance. So that's why I know that this result I showed you is actually in steady state. Okay, and the fact that this is positive says that we have a downscale transfer of enstrophy, just as we expected, as Feuerstaub told us, and also, we notice it's independent of wave number, and many people look at that and they said, ah, we have a cascade just from that picture, and it doesn't mean that at all. In fact, this is a trivial consequence of energy conservation or entropy conservation, that this is flat in a steady state. It must be, because you're not putting anything in or anything out. Okay. Here again, I've got this molecular cutoff in. Okay, so there's no dissipation in this range. If you put the cutoff in, this is what it'll look like, and it's just a little harder to see. So pedagogically, I find it easier to look at both of these. You know, I find it easier to have the cutoff so I can really see what I'm doing. Okay, and of course, one thing I should mention with in either of these figures, if you cascade energy to the large scales, a little bit of the entropy, of course, goes up as well to the large scales. That's been noted many times. And however, the entropy may go to large scales, but not in a uniform, not with a uniform flux, of course. You can't have a uniform flux of energy and entropy. Okay, so here's what the vorticity field looks like with molecular viscosity. And here's what it looks like with the cutoff. It's quite different, you know, so one does have to be careful. And, you know, this is also an argument for being careful with any hyperviscosity. The difference between these two figures is quite striking. You see a lot of high gradients here. Right. So it's kind of interesting to see the movie there. And so we can even show a 3D visualization of this. This is done with asymptote. I'll just have to click to load. Adobe's a little bit slow loading these 3D figures sometimes. But this is a vorticity field, this time with molecular viscosity. And as soon as that loads, the previewer we have is much faster to load, with the OpenGL previewer for asymptote. And that's what I normally use. But the advantage of this is that you can embed this right within a PDF file, and then you can go in and look at your various valleys and hills and things like that. So that's kind of fun to do. I just lost power. And I'm sorry about that. I should have brought my adapter. I think what it is actually that I have a new battery, which is great, except it seems to this company that produces the batteries, I had another one from them. If you with a high power drain, it sometimes does that. And it never occurred to me that might happen. Okay, so we'll have to reboot. I think maybe while it's rebooting, I run and get my power adapter. If you apologize, I'll be right back. I'll just leave this here. We might have enough power to finish, but just in case.
Christoph.
So when you're saying that, you know, these, you take about 100 to any turn over time, and then this thing is actually stationary from then on, there's...
Well, it depends on the friction, you know. In the experiment, we can vary friction by putting a lubricant, a layer of dielectric, which is not forced by, and then we can vary the friction. But it's all, I mean, practically, this is... Everything is a matter of size, because your typical time scale is basically a matter of size, because velocities that we can drive, they are basically determined by the strength of magnetic field. So, because we vary boxes, the largest we can use is actually something like 40 centimeters. And, you know, Bob Etkin tried to get this one meter, and it never actually worked. So. And if you have this 40 centimeters as this typical velocity, which is, you know, centimeters per second, 10 centimeters, the time scales are pretty low. I mean, they are kind of tens of seconds up to a minute.
And it's over, but then you're stationary from that.
No, which means that this is a typical turnover time. Now, we really need a friction coefficient to be of order of turnover time to stop it. Okay? Well, it could be less, I don't know, like, but basically it never would go into days and so on. It's really, nobody managed to make thin layer configuration larger than 30, 40 centimeters. It just blows up, you know, just as well. Look, we all waited for Bob Etkin to make this great 1 meter by 1 meter.
But it never worked.
It actually never worked, right?
He's coming.
He's coming, yeah.
He will ask him. That's the one question we will have for him.
Exactly. He'll got
another grant.
He got another grant and then switched it.
Okay. So shall I start at the beginning? Okay.
No, not from the very beginning.
Okay. How are we doing for time? Okay. Oh, we're almost. Okay. I guess we still got a little time. Okay. Okay, so I showed you that. No, I showed you that. Okay, so now let's talk about what I'm really here to tell you about is the transfer of a particular chasm. I'm going to pick this one first. It's the fourth power of the vorticity, so it's nice because it's quadratic. I mean, it's positive definite, is what I'm trying to say. It's quartic, and I'll normalize it so it looks nice in Fourier space. And so you see you've got this double convolution. So I originally called this the biconvolution, and then was interested in numerically evaluating hyperconvolutions without having insane amounts of padding, right? Anyway, Malcolm convinced me I should call this kind of thing the kind of thing that arises here a ternary convolution. So I don't know what the best term is. There doesn't seem to be a standard term for this, but it's essentially just a double convolution. Okay, so what I did is look at the evolution equation for this, and so here it is here. I'm very interested in how the, not doing this sum over k, I want to leave that out. I'm interested in the term in the brackets here and plotting that term as a function of k. And where's the contribution, the various contributions in this balance come from that makes this equal to zero, okay? Approximately zero, because we're talking about a truncated system here. And so this is what, here sk is the nonlinear source term for the vorticity equation. And this is what we need to compute. And rather than computing that in wave number space, which would be very time consuming, we go to x space, and this double convolution can be written as a Fourier transform of a cubic. And so we use a pseudo spectral method to compute this. And same thing with this one here. The only difference between these two terms is that one of the omegas here gets replaced by an s, by a source. And there are three such terms, and so that's where the three comes from. Okay, so what we want to do then is compute T4 of k, the various contributions to the evolution of the fourth order chasm here. All right, and so this is what it looks like. If we run a little longer, these waves may disappear. I'm rerunning it. To see if that still appears. Actually, I think what I decided, these are actually a result of non-conservation. Okay, so they really should be flat in a steady state. So I have to still run long to be sure that I'm actually in a steady state there. And one of the other things I'm doing is computing, like I did before, computing the linear and forcing contributions to this term too, and making sure they're in balance. And that way we'll know it's, we've got a reliable result. So this suggests that we get a downscale transfer of Z4, not upscale. So it suggests that Iink was right. However, I haven't shown a cascade any more than I did for an entropy cascade. So a cascade means that you have the same amount of flux going between through any wave number here, that you got self-similarity. That's what I mean by a cascade. And so what I'm saying is one should really distinguish between the flux and the transfer, which I'm going to tell you in the next slide. This is just a slide about implicit dealiasing. Maybe I just mentioned that first. So to compute Z4, you have to take the Fourier transform of a cubic quantity like this. And I understand there's other cases like compressible turbulence where you need to take Fourier transforms of cubic quantities as well. And in that case, you need a 2-4-0 padding rule. That's one way of doing it. There were other ways suggested last week, like you could do one convolution at a time. So that's going to be quite expensive. I think this is more efficient, except you don't want to have to do explicit padding. That's definitely inefficient. But instead of doing that, like here's how inefficient it is. If you have a truncation wave number 512, you need a Dealey's pseudospectral simulation of size, of buffer size, 2048 by 2048. So instead, you should use implicit padding. That requires half of the memory of this. It still requires some extra memory. And the reason it requires some extra memory is when you Fourier transform, you do, and the reason that people quote these sizes, and some, in fairness to people who do quote numbers like this instead of the number of Dealey's modes, they're saying, well, this is the number of X space modes that I have, or the X space samples that I have. And it's true, in one dimension, you do have to do this expansion. You do get this, you do have to use this many modes. But what you can do is use that same, so you need to expand with the 3/2 rule. You expand your data by 3/2 in one dimension. That's always necessary. But you don't have to do it in both dimensions. You can use what I'm saying is you don't have to use this extra padding in both directions, because you can use that padding, that work memory, over in the other dimension and reuse it. And there's a trick how you can do that, which I discussed last week. So that's the key thing, why it saves memory. It's computing exactly the same thing. It's just a faster way of getting the same answer. All right. So this is the memory savings for the 2/3 rule. The memory saving is 2/3 to d-1. There's no savings in one dimension. The savings comes at dimensions 2 and 3. And for the particular padding I'm doing right now, it's the 2/4 padding to compute the transfer of Z4. Then I need to use that rule. This is only for computing Z4. The actual code, the evolution of the vorticity, is still done with the usual 2/3 rule, okay, but implicit padding. All right. So, and as I mentioned, these convolution routines have been implemented as a software layer, FFTW++, on top of the well-known FFTW, a highly regarded library. And so it's available on SourceForge. Okay, so like I said, I want to distinguish between transfer and flux. I want to leave this closing idea that I think we have to be more careful when we talk about cascades. As I said, in a steady state, pi of k will trivially be constant within a true inertial range, independent of Kolmogorov's theory. All right, it's a trivial statement. It's just a consequence of entropy conservation. The flux, this is what Kolmogorov was talking about. The flux through a wave number k is the amount of entropy transferred to scales via triad interactions involving mode k. So mode k is the mediator that makes this interaction possible. If the energy doesn't end up in mode k, you're passing through this invisible membrane that we put in wave number space and looking at transfers across. If that transfer doesn't actually involve a triad at scale, at wave number k, then it's not a flux. It's not what Kolmogorov was talking about. He was talking about this little transfer from eddies of similar sizes, not from very different sized eddies. Now, of course, in 2D turbulence, we know that there is a lot of non-locality as well. And that non-locality doesn't imply, I think Gregory Iink made this point, that non-locality doesn't imply there's no self-similarity, because you could have a picture as a drawing, I guess, you could have a picture like this, where you have non-local transfers.
What is this? What is on axis?
So here I'm graphing just the energy spectrum here. And what I'm saying is the transfers could be quite non-local, or even more extreme. You could have, you know, transfers are very, very non-local, but you could still have self-similarity, right? Something like that. So so what we really want to do is find out how local are the transfers in 2D, and Hussein Alloui looked into this, and I want to discuss this one a little bit further, because I think there's a more detailed way of doing this, making this distinction between transfers, non-local transfers, and local fluxes. And so it involves doing things at the triad level of triads. And what I think we need to do is calculate something like this. This is this little cartoon shows all the different contributions. L here means large, and S means small. So L I'm looking at the contributions coming from large scales. So the contributions coming from large scales into mode K is TK, but there's nothing coming in from the small scales. Okay, so small scales are out here. This is one possibility where K is the highest wave number. K could be the middle wave number. And then we've got transfers coming from the large scales, TP, and transfers coming from the small scales, TQ. What I want to do is decompose which of the transfers are coming from the large scales and which are coming from the small scales. Similarly here, now we get a transfer from the small scales. That's the only contribution. Energy is still conserved. So L plus S is still equal to T, the total. This is just a statement of energy conservation here. So what I really want to do is just to calculate, instead of calculating the whole TK, I just want to compute one component of it. I know the total, I want to compute one component of it, say LK, and then I immediately know SK. And this requires computing what I call a restricted Fourier transform. And I didn't know how to do this until recently, but there's recent work by Liang et al. That show how to compute rather efficiently with the kind of FFT scaling that we would like. He calls them partial Fourier transforms. And maybe that's a good term, because just like a partial sum, you're computing only some of the components. The key thing is the cutoff is k-dependent. And that's what makes this hard. If the cutoff wasn't k-dependent, then you could just restrict, for example, if you wanted to implement that, you could simply make omega p, restrict omega p, zero it out after that wave number. So you could just truncate omega p. But the problem is that upper cutoff depends on k itself. And so you need to do this, you have a different cutoff for every k, and that means you have to do a whole bunch of FFTs, and then you're too slow. And that's the problem. So, however, there is a solution to this problem, which I was really happy to see. It just came out 2 years ago, and I found out about 6 months ago, and I think it's a really nice idea, which probably can be proved on. So that might answer the question about, you know, the question that Hussein was looking at and others were discussing, how local is turbulence. I think it's a key ingredient of the Kolmogorov theory that we should, by now, try to really answer conclusively. And I also see it as a way of trying to build a subgrid model. I think this information could be used if we knew how much, what the energy hops are like. Then, if we cut off the spectrum, we'll be able to infer what we should do to mimic that behavior of these transfers. And so, I want to create a profile of how much does the energy jump at various scales, and is that profile independent of scale? Is there really self-similarity? That's what I want to look at in wave number space. In conclusion, I want to just emphasize that even though higher Casimir invariants do not survive wave number truncation, and for this reason I told my colleague Johan Shah Davoodi that we couldn't look at it, we couldn't help him numerically, we couldn't answer the question. It was only later I realized, next time I saw him at another meeting, that maybe there was some hope, and we worked something out on the blackboard, and I realized that we probably could do it. And sure enough, this work shows that you can, at least in the case of the and make it to the fourth invariant, it does seem to cascade to small scales. It appears to, although I haven't really proven that we have a cascade, just a transfer. So more work has to be done, and that's why I'm talking about this local versus non-local transfer stuff. All right. I did look at another invariant. In fact, the first thing I looked at, it seemed obvious instead of looking at omega squared, I should just look at omega cubed. So that was the first thing I looked at. And it was rather silly of me because that's not a positive definite quantity. And so it doesn't have definite sign. And because of that, you don't really expect to get a cascade. In fact, I didn't get one numerically. It appeared to slosh back and forth between the large and small scales. And so sometimes it's cascading to the large scales and sometimes to the small scales. And on average, it's not cascading anywhere. So that was not really, in hindsight, very surprising. And as I said, one should distinguish between non-local transfers and local fluxes. And to do this efficiently, one needs to compute a partial fast Fourier transform efficiently. So thank you for your time. I put this for Eberhard because he was asking about asymptotes. So there's the link there, the address there.
There are two co-authors, and so I'm commenting for both of us.
Yes.
I probably forgot to tell you. I saw that I did. In 94, I mean,
yes,
before I
did. Infinite number of conservation laws of this paper? Yes.
And we actually put forward a very simple argument about those high integrals of motion, that there's no doubt that they absorb at large k. That's not the point. Mm-hmm. The point is whether they are pumped at low k. Mm-hmm. Because to talk about cascade, you need an inertial interval. And quadratic integral is easy because you have Parseval theorem, so if you force at a given k, so you put energy into mode with a given k. Now, if you write your equation and you have a forcing which has a given Fourier component, it does not mean that one can consider omega to the 4, which is not quadratic quantity, and you can make any meaningful spectral representation of it, that it would not be actually forced at a k which is in what you think is inside the inertial interval. And then what we slowly call the phenomenon of distributed pumping, namely, and it depends on the form of spectra, and I don't want now to write all the theory, it might take 15 minutes to explain it. But the idea was that the integrals, higher integrals, aren't pumped at low k. There is a slow, logarithmically slow contribution.
At high k.
At low k. So it's a direct cascade. So it's a forcing is at low k. But the
pumped by the forcing or by
non-linear
by the forcing.
Forcing.
Well, it depends on the forcing you
the
choose, right?
No, we assume that the forcing is localized at low k, like in your case.
Okay, and white noise
so
forcing.
So entropy is definitely pumped in low k. But when you consider higher moments, then you always have kind of a reducible contribution into these moments, which would be force omega omega correlation function. And you need to check whether they would contribute the pumping of omega to the 4. And our conclusion was that if your spectrum is close to the k minus 3, not decaying fast, that would be a different story. Then there would be, and it seems that that's what you see. When you see this peak, it a little bit goes up, which actually means that you are adding there.
If
you
go back to the result.
Go back. One. You see, when you had before for square integrals, it was just a plain constant. Here you have this kind of growing up, which our interpretation would
but
be.
But the constant even decaying.
And then it decays because of your display. But and we call it distributed pumping. So the pumping is not, if you consider high integrals of motion, at least I never were able to invent how I would locally pump this high order integrals of motion, even when my force is a small k. So in a sense, I would say that the whole picture need to be resort, including this phenomenon of distributed pumping. But the general, of course, direction is towards large k.
Polyakov didn't agree, though.
But I would call cascade something which goes through a transparency window, inertial interval. So that you can really guarantee that for a given mode, there is no influence of pumping.
Right.
But then what is a given mode for the quantity omega to the 4? What is a given mode? So you take omega to the 4 and Fourier, you can take a field which is omega to the 4 and Fourier transform it. But no, that's not what you do. You take omega and Fourier transform it, get omega k. Now omega to the 4, it's a non-trivial convolution of all those omegas.
Yeah.
But on some of them, forcing actually act. So you need to check whether forcing directly act when you interpret it as a, as an interval.
I mean, here we see there is definitely pumping here at this wave number. But you're wondering, is there any pumping in here too?
What I'm saying is that the fact that this is not a constant, which is free, like it was for Einstein.
Einstein
was just plain constant.
Right.
For me, and then if you want what I want to know, is that that's probably this slow growth.
I see, it could be,
Our statement was that this is a slow growth, this is a logarithmic.
Yes. Yeah,
this is something which is logarithmically slow. But it would not contradict this. So maybe you would really observe this phenomenon of distributed pumping, which we predicted 17 years ago.
You mentioned your paper last week to me, and
at least it would be nice to check that our predictions do not contradict to this problem.
And if you look at our paper, there is just some direct statement about force order moments.
Right.
So how would them really get it?
I looked at it briefly, but you just mentioned to me last week, and I hadn't had a
Time. Yeah, okay, so just no problem.
Yes, the original, as you mentioned, the field doctor. The demonstration was that when you impose the entropy along with the energy, energy then cascades to energy cascades inversely. But then, what if you start bringing in this higher order vorticity invariants? Energy will still cascade to the large wavelengths.
Yeah, I mean it's a good question. What do these chasm invariants do to the Fyodorov argument and Kolmogorov's argument too? Why are they ignored? Many numerists say, well, because they don't survive truncation. So they're not really accessible to us. But that's not really a good answer, right?
They definitely impose a restriction on the
They restrict to only consider rearrangements of the original initial conditions and barring viscosity-viscous effects.
Yeah. My guess would be that we have some strange beauties in the Dvorsky scale because this is earlier equation which has a very non-trivial structure. It should conserve infinite number of conservation. So in this sense, in Dvorsky scale, it's also dependent on those models of motion.
Yeah.
But the way
I guess then the Fyodorov demonstration was kind of restrictive, kind of made it look like only entropy was required. But maybe
just counting.
So this again was with the cutoff. So if I didn't have the cutoff, then it would go down. It was a chance to actually see this wave structure. Let's try to see if we can explain that based on your ideas. That's good. Okay.
Yes. You had this comment that it's so dangerous to have hyperviscosity because then you had all this small structure. What do you really mean by this? So in astrophysics, we always do.
I know, and it's because you're desperate, right? What we really need is a better subgrid model than hyperviscosity, and I'm working on one. I have something this thing called spec reduction, which I now have working in a pseudospectral with pseudospectral speed. So it's a reduced model where you've been, and now the million-dollar question was, how do we hook this up to your simulation? We basically can model the inertial range down very deep, because that's what you want. You want a subgrid model that models not the dissipation range only, but also the inertial range.
Right. So
a hyperviscosity. Here's an argument that due to Zabuski many years ago, why you can't just arbitrarily replace this power of the Laplacian instead of you could take a bi-Laplacian, a delta to the fourth instead of delta squared. But that's clearly wrong, because a Laplacian does something special to a maxima. It's negative, and so it damps it. That's what the diffusion equation is all about. And of course, a bi-Laplacian has the opposite sign. And so you definitely don't want to consider that particular power. So you got to be careful. Yes.
Can I also add a comment to this? So what one can check in numerics, that if you, it depends on what you're interested in. If you're interested in the spectra, so it turns out that you can do something with your dissipation range and spectra will survive. But if you say you can change, Reynolds number with a given cutoff so that it's the Kolmogorov scale always hits this cutoff. But if you're interested in something else, some geometrical properties of the flow, you can spoil them.
I think it's particularly dangerous in 2D because you've got this inverse cascade. So if you start tampering at small scales, it's like injecting a forcing there, the small scales. And that information could propagate back. Hopefully it's small enough that it's not going to really destroy things, but that's the concern I have. Yeah.
Even for spectra, even for spectra, hyperviscosity can do bad things. It gives you a more pronounced bottleneck.
What's a bottleneck? That's right.
And the bottleneck tail will go and pollute your inertial range with any finite resolution. So it's not what the purist would advise you to do.
But if you have no other choice, you know, what do you? I mean, we have to give you a better choice. That's the thing. Yeah, a better
sub. The other choice is modesty.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Let me remind you that